I thank the organizers for putting all this together and giving me the opportunity to give this talk. I was told that I have 15 minutes to summarize my work, what I'm thinking about. And there's a lot to say, not a lot of time. And pictures are worth 1,000 words, so there's a lot of pictures. So the question I wanted to address was, okay, so we have this very nice duality that people in quantum field theory and strings are very interested in, called the ADS-CFT duality or the gauge gravity duality. And well, as a person from GR background, I was very interested in some basic questions like, what does it mean to have a general covariance in this picture, or what translates to that? So sketch is that in the ultraviolet, we have an ultraviolet quantum field theory, a conformal field theory. And then there's some RG flow being triggered. And then there's this bulk described by gravity plus matter, weakly coupled matter, in one higher dimension, presumably some other quantum field theory living in the IR. And that this radial direction is the energy scale, and that it's an emergent direction in the bulk. And this is very nice. And as Todd described this morning, there are very nice applications of this to studying quantum properties of quantum field theories or even condensed matter systems near quantum or classical phase transitions. But then I say, well, wait a minute. I know that general relativity describes things like two black holes that, you know, orbit each other, give off gravitational waves, and so on, and that, you know, this theory is generally covariant, which means that it's invariant under change of local changes of coordinates. And clearly there's this funny emergent direction here, which has to be treated on equal footing with all the other directions if the theory has to contain general relativity. So what gives? And in trying to answer this question, I believe that, or I will argue that I found a criterion that theories that possess holographic duals have to satisfy away from the fixed point, away from criticality. This has to be satisfied at every scale in the renormalization group flow. So let's throw away the black holes and so on for a second and think about how we should really describe gravity to fit this holographic picture nicely. So it's in the Hamiltonian formulation, and as Joop described, although not this kind of picture, what gravity does is it takes embedded hypersurfaces in space-time. You can split space-time into space and time, and then it tells you very specifically how to evolve these slices of space. So there's these two constraints describing, well, normal and tangential deformations of hypersurfaces that are embedded in space-time. And these are basically concocted such that if one were to look at space-time as a whole, everything remains generally covariant and so on. So there's something very peculiar about this Hamiltonian. And this peculiarity is what will be important, because I can look at a very analogous picture, in describing coarse graining. So if I take the holographic this holographic story very seriously, then I have a quantum field theory living in the ultraviolet, and I can think of renormalization group transformations as local rescalings. So I have a coarse graining transformation that depends on space. So these little circles get zoomed out, and, you know, it acts point-wise, and it's very analogous to the picture we saw previously about what the Hamiltonian, the general relativity Hamiltonian, is doing. But of course, to quantum field theory, this is some form of a blocking transformation. And what is a blocking transformation in all generality? Well, it's just a field redefinition. And there's a huge freedom in how we can choose to redefine fields. And this roughly corresponds to the freedom in choosing a renormalization group scheme. So if I were to just, so it might not, one might not be able to recognize it straight away, but you could derive, for instance, the exact renormalization group equations or the Polchinski equations from this trick. I mean, that's why they're self-consistent identities defining the partition function, because they're just describing such field redefinitions. And of course, I could perform another field redefinition, and this kernel would change in that way. So now we can ask, okay, so I know that from this holographic story that I'm just given a quantum field theory, and I want to know if it possesses holographic dual. Well, come what may, I have to be able to block it in such a way that these redefinitions should mimic the action of the Hamiltonian and vector constraints of general relativity. And okay, so can we turn that into something a little bit more concise? And so,
are you implicitly assuming that it is a time-like killing vector?
No. So this is just the standard Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. So
that's why I'm asking.
Right, which doesn't assume any. Yeah, so that's also why the Hamiltonian, for instance, vanishes. It's a sum of just constraints. If I had a killing vector field, then I would argue that there's an energy corresponding to the conserved charge there. And
the energy could still be zero.
Sure, it could still be zero, but strictly speaking of systems where I've not assumed any symmetry, no global killing vectors. But there's a somewhat trivial fact that, so as I mentioned before, this Hamiltonian that's generating the normal deformations of hypersurfaces has to do so in a way that knows that this hypersurface is embedded in space-time, or one higher dimensional space-time. And this was an observation of Teitelborn's, that this is encoded in looking at the commutator of two different such Hamiltonians. So what I mean by that is that I have the smearing, the lapse, which again Jobe was talking about, and Jobe in his talk was integrating over it because it's a Lagrange multiplier, but of course it's a Lagrange multiplier corresponding to a constraint, so I can smear the Hamiltonian with two different lapses and consider the difference, so the commutator of two Hamiltonians, and I should be able to absorb the difference into one of these tangential diffeomorphisms along a hypersurface. And now there was a paper by Hodgman, Kukash, and Teitelboim where what they proved was that granted the phase space of general relativity, which is phase space of theory of metrics on a hypersurface and the conjugate momenta, and I just know the algebra, the constraint algebra of these functions, this is sufficient information to reconstruct the functions. So now, if we're in a situation where we're trying to construct the bulk theory starting from the renormalization group flow of some quantum field theory, and this goes under the limerick of the quantum renormalization group that Sung-Sik Lee here at Perimeter is responsible for, and also, well, very similar things are done by Rob Lee there in the audience. But if I'm interested in having general relativity, gravity plus a couple to matter fields emerging in the bulk, then I'd better want that to be replicated by these blocking transformations. And now, so in other words, a commutator of two blocking transformations. So if they're composed with different local Weyl factors, should be undone by some diffeomorphism. I can write this more neatly in terms of the partition function, where I relate the warded entity of.
Sorry, here you didn't say that the sigma is a local.
Yeah, sorry. So, yeah.
Local rescaling as lats.
Yeah, exactly. So sigma is basically the analog of N, the lapse, but for the coarse graining or blocking transformation that I've described here. And written in terms of just the partition function, the free energy, this is the form this takes. It relates the warded entity for anomalous or broken scale transformations to the warded entity of diffeomorphism invariants. Of course, this identically vanishes because hopefully we've coupled the theory properly to a curved background. And one can show, in the circumstances where one can check this, that provided this and properties such as the theory possessing a large number of degrees of freedom, so large N or large C, and a sparse spectrum, which are the usual assumptions that people have for theories that possess holographic duals, they will possess, so you can construct the holographic dual with this additional bit of information. So I'll summarize. So if I was just thinking using effective field theory logic, then I would say that general relativity is a theory of a dynamical metric. And then what I need to know is what the symmetries of gauge invariances are to write down theories of the dynamical metric. And so we should care about diffeomorphism invariants if we're interested in picking out general relativity. Now, you can use this to say that, okay, for theories that possess holographic duals, that has to be encoded in a composition law for the RG transformations. Conversely, this allows us to come up with a criterion which says that quantum field theories that respond to local renormalization group transformations that respect this funny composition law, in addition to some other conditions, possess holographic duals. So, Professor Me.
So if I ask you for, let's say, a simple field theory, scalar, let's not take three, but a lambda phi to the fourth.
Okay.
Would you say that this applies to lambda phi to the fourth? Would lambda phi to the fourth have a dual?
Well, it would have some dual, but it wouldn't be gravity coupled to some matter. I mean, if I tried to construct it, it would be some.
You have to see a codimension one dual.
Yes, for this criterion applies to codimension one duals.
And it has to be a space time.
Yeah, I'm also assuming the usual sparse spectrum and large n that these two things can be made sense of.
The four doesn't have large
n. Sure. So what I mean is that. If I was given any of the quantum field theories that people usually think of as having holographic duals, and if I were to trigger an RG flow away from the fixed point where most of the studies of ADS-CFT happen, then I have a means of I have a simple means of constructing a holographic dual, if and only if such a property is in one way or the other satisfied. So it's a criterion that is at play away from the fixed point. At the fixed point, of course, the right hand side is just identically zero. Because the theory is a Weyl invariant, it's a conformal field theory. So I would say that if I had, say, n equals 4 or something, and I had add your favorite deformation, trigger an RG flow, then. So that's the sense in which I mean that it's an additional criterion that theories that possess holographic duals have to satisfy. Okay. Thank you. So Professor Turk, I'm in the process of checking this in the context of two-dimensional conformal field theories with large central charge deformed by a composite of the stress tensor. So there's been very recent study on this by Verlinde and his collaborators, and I'm close to working things out. There and it all looks fine. I mean, as you can see, it's just that the Hamiltonian constraint should do what it does. Mm-hmm. So, and the virtue of this is it's an off-shell criteria. Mm-hmm. So I'm not reproducing some particular geometry. I'm reproducing the Einstein-Hilbert action in the bulk. So
how does the lambda pole of lambda phi to the four appear in this?
That's what I'm saying, that I'm not talking about lambda. I'm really thinking about theories that you have other reasons also to believe possess holographic duals. So if you're asking what. No, I'm saying that this has to hold at every scale, including the IR. So if I was thinking about, say, n equals 4 triggered by some, not thinking about conformal perturbation theory, I've added like a relevant operator with a finite coupling in front of the operator, then.
Criterion is local in energy scale, right? Because
yes, yes.
Some infinite number deformations of the
energy. Yeah, yeah.
So if you were to extrapolate, how does the lambda hole look gravitationally?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about it. So I suppose one would expect some or the other kind of singularity, because that's exactly what the lambda hole is to an RG flow, right? But as you know, that's a perturbative statement. Non-perturbatively, you'll find that these theories just don't exist.
How about the synthetic freedom? That's a statement that you would define around a Gaussian fixed point in principle, but it's not, you're not at a fixed point, you're asymptotically free.
Sure.
So you could define it perturbatively.
Right, yeah, so you could define it. Yeah, I agree. And?
So you would say that there is a holographic dual to that, to asymptotic holography theory?
I mean, this is, I should mention this is a digression from the point of this talk, but I think that using tools such as what Professor Lee or Sangsik would use, you could try to construct a so-called dual to an asymptotically free theory, except it won't be local and it probably won't be classical. So then this kind of mapping just won't be very useful. You might as well just study the asymptotically free theory with perturbation theory the way you usually do. So when I say theories that possess holographic duals, what I mean is that the holographic dual is some kind of classical theory. I mean, the bottom line is that it's a simpler theory to study than the original theory in perturbation theory. So, I mean, if you truly believe ADS-CFT, then yes, right? I mean, you would say that any theory should possess some or the other kind of holographic dual. It might not be classical. You need to take some special limits for it to be, to have nice properties.
Any more questions? Still have like 5 minutes. If not, then let's thank Bas again.